Alto. Among the Alto's many innovations was the graphical user interface. The Alto had overlapping windows, menus, icons, and fonts. From those elements, the first modern word processing, email, and paint programs were built. Other computers, built by Park, could create psychedelic video and cartoon animation in full color. Underlying all of it was the so-called bitmap display. Each pixel on Park's many computer screens was mapped, connected to a bit in memory. Butler Lampson. The pitch was, Xerox is starting this new lab, and it's a long way away from Rochester, and the charter is to invent the office of the future. And nobody quite knows what that means, so we should be able to make it anything we want. And there's plenty of money. Chuck Thacker. What we did was very simple. We spent a lot of money to simulate the future. Butler Lampson. Our game was to build time machines. It was extremely clear that the machines that we were building in the early and mid-70s would be economical in the 80s, and it was extremely clear that they were wildly uneconomical at the time we built them. Alan Kay. Through money and assuming Moore's Law, you can basically put a supercomputer on a desk, which is what we did. Dan Ingalls. It was almost a free ride because so many things were just ready to be invented. The entire world of bitmapped graphics was there to be invented. Bob Metcalf. And it was California, so we rode bicycles. I remember we used to ride our bikes along Arrastradero Road over to Alpine Road and go to the Alpine Inn at lunchtime. We would drink beer at lunch, and that meant the afternoon was gone and that work might resume that evening after dinner. It was very laid back. There was only one meeting per week. We'd sit in these beanbag chairs and we would discuss what was going on at the lab. It was a very idyllic time. Dick Shoup. We were all trying to figure out what to do. Steve Jobs. They were doing some computer research, which was basically an extension of some stuff started by a guy named Doug Engelbart when he was at SRI. Bob Taylor. Engelbart's work influenced me a lot. Some of our people spent summers on occasion working in Engelbart's group before there was a Park. Alan Kay. I date Park from 1971, basically the 5 years through 1975. That's when most of the stuff got done. Chuck Thacker. The first thing we did was try to figure out what we would use for computing resources. And we looked at SDS, because Xerox had just bought Scientific Data Systems. Butler Lampson. The standard computer for computer science research at that time was the DEC PDP-10. We needed to be able to run the PDP-10 software, because that's what all the other researchers were running. Charles Simonyi. But DEC was a competitor to Xerox, so it was completely politically incorrect for Xerox to have a competitor's machine for their research. Chuck Thacker. And we realized that it would really be unseemly if we bought a PDP-10 from DEC. So we built one, the MAXC. Alan Kay. It stands for Multiple Access Xerox Computer. Chuck Thacker. I designed the memory, Butler designed the processor, and you could do that in those days. Charles Simonyi. There was this wonderful tradition that new people had to do a shit job. That's what it was called in the vernacular. So my job at Xerox was building the MAXC. Bruce Horn. I was the guy who would do the backups at night, and I'd go and, you know, put the tapes on the thing and run all the backups and everything. So that's kind of fun. Not bad for a 14-year-old. Dick Shoup. We all were playing with Space War. There was really nothing else to do then because we were building things. Park's first outside visitor of note was Stuart Brand, fresh from editing and publishing the last Whole Earth catalog, and newly famous as a result of its countercultural success. He came to Park for the tour in 1972. Stuart Brand. I went to Jan Wenner at Rolling Stone and said, I want to do this story about what's going on with computers. And he said, fine, go ahead and do it. He was doing it based totally on his good feelings about the Whole Earth catalog. Alan Kay. Stewart and I knew each other a bit. He contacted me and said he was going to do a piece basically on Space War. Stewart Brand. What I had seen with Space War was that it drove the technology. It drove the human interface faster than any other application. Alan Kay. The game of Space War blossoms spontaneously wherever there is a graphics display connected to a computer. Stewart Brand. Bear in mind that I had seen people playing Space War as early as 1962 in the computer labs at Stanford. They were young, randomly dressed people in a back room of a nice Stanford office, crying out with joy and excitement about something. And that something was the game. Steve Russell. There were games on computers before Space War, but Space War was very influential because it circulated through lots of colleges and universities, so everyone who was interested in computers in the 1960s all knew about it. Stuart Brand. That was my first inkling that there was something going on around computers that was not the standard New Left take on computers, which was that they were dire instruments of control. Lee Felsenstein. The line was that they were instruments of the future in terms of automating production. The New Left didn't think that was such a great idea. Stuart Brand. Amongst the general flow of hippie romanticism, there was an opposition to technology, and by implication, an opposition to science. And I thought that was dreadful. Lee Felsenstein. Those who sneered at computers had no involvement with them. It was a convenient thing to do from a distance, but if you had any degree of involvement with them, you came to love the magic of it, the romance of it, as Alan Kay put it. Bob Taylor. When Stewart Brand showed up, I had no idea he was coming. I didn't know why he was there. I didn't know who put him up to it. He said, well, we just want to talk to a few people. Stewart Brand didn't just want to talk to me. He wanted to talk to a lot of people. He wanted to find out what was going on. I said, okay, fine. So I encouraged him, and he did his thing. I saw nothing wrong with it. Stewart Brand. Alan Kay was definitely my avenue into understanding the Xerox PARC and a great deal more. He just introduced me to his perspective on what was going to become personal computers, and probably he used that term offhandedly, which I'd then put in print. It became the standard usage. He was very articulate and operated on a level of abstraction in terms of having a theory of what's going on that was reminiscent of Doug Engelbart, though Alan talked and acted like more of an engineer with a strategic vision. Doug acted more like the visionary with the visionary vision, I suppose. Alan Kay. Stewart wrote a very good piece. Unfortunately, Rolling Stone was a rag in those days, a West Coast rag, not an East Coast rag. Stewart Brand, writing in Rolling Stone. Ready or not, computers are coming to the people. That's good news. Maybe the best since psychedelics. It's way off the track of the computers threat or menace school of liberal criticism, but surprisingly in line with the romantic fantasies of the forefathers of the science. These are heads, most of them. Half or more of computer science is heads. John Markoff. One of the terms of art then was head, meaning acid head. Alvy Ray Smith. Corporate Xerox was three-piece button-down suits, businessmen in western New York State. Then they found out there was this place out in California that was all beanbag chairs and hippies riding bikes and wearing sandals. Dick Shoup. They felt it made Xerox look bad, and we shouldn't have let it happen. Stewart Brand, writing in Rolling Stone. Until computers come to the people, we will have no real idea of their most natural functions. Up to the present, their cost and size has kept them in the province of rich and powerful institutions, who, understandably, have developed them primarily as bookkeeping, sorting, and control devices. The computers have been a priceless aid in keeping the lid on top-down organization. Bob Taylor. Xerox thought themselves to be a very responsible, upright, solid citizen corporation. They thought Rolling Stone was a rag magazine of degenerated hippies and would have nothing to do with them, and didn't want Rolling Stone to have anything to do with Xerox. Alan Kay. And so Xerox went batshit when they saw it. Stuart Brand, writing in Rolling Stone. Alan Kay is designing a handheld, standalone, interactive graphic computer about the size, shape, and diversity of a whole Earth catalog, electric, called Dynabook. It's mostly high-resolution display screen with a keyboard on the lower third and various cassette loading slots, optional hookup plugs, etc. And that is the general bent of research at Xerox. Soft, away from hugeness and centrality, toward the small and personal, toward putting maximum computer power in the hands of every individual who wants it. Alvy Ray Smith. He had written up Xerox Park as a hippie place. Bob Taylor. Xerox Corporate had apoplexy. Alvy Ray Smith. They went non-linear. Stuart Brand. They put an armed guard at the door and they didn't let reporters in ever after. Dick Shoup. But of course, from our point of view, we were proud to be on the leading edge and trying to move Xerox and anybody else who would listen into the future, because we could see what was coming. Stuart Brand, writing in Rolling Stone. When computers become available to everybody, the hackers take over. Bob Metcalf. Right after we finished MAXC, we started work on the Alto computer, arguably the world's first personal computer. Chuck Thacker. And we finally started listening to Bob Taylor, who had been telling us what to do for a long time, but we didn't understand it. Bob Taylor. The design center of computers in those days was the arithmetic unit. Everything, all the design, was focused on making that as efficient as possible. So I said, look, the eyeball is the connection between the brain and the computer. The computer, therefore, has to be centered on the display. And furthermore, it has to be personal. We want one for every user. Chuck Thacker. Taylor had this bee in his bonnet. He thought that computers were not really just for computing. They were communication devices. And he kept trying to explain it to us, why this was very important and we didn't understand it. And finally we did, and one of the things we realized was that if you wanted to communicate with it, it kind of had to be personal. Bob Metcalf. Can you imagine that? A computer on every desk. Wow. Very controversial in 1973. Why would you want a computer on your desk? What possible use could there be for such a thing? I remember people had that discussion. Charles Simone. Alan Kay had a clear vision of the Dynabook, and he was talking about it all the time. Alvy Ray Smith. His idea was that the computer should be simple enough that a kid could use it. He saw it all. He was very clear about it. Alan Kay. Because of my experience with Seymour Papert, I got converted from thinking about computers as tools for adults to thinking about them as media, like reading and writing. And once I got that idea, you have to make it usable for children, which means that the user interface has to be very different. Larry Tesler. We had a diagram with an idea of what the user interface might look like. It didn't look at all like the Mac or Windows. It looked more like a 3D room. A desk, a file cabinet in the corner, things on the desk, and a trash can next to the desk. Alan Kay. What we wanted was something like a room, an area for a project where we keep all the tools. Larry Tesler. The idea was that you could point to stuff that looked semi-realistic, representational, but it was not equal-sized icons like we have today. Alan Kay loved it. And so Alan Kay, Park's software theorist, got together with Park's resident hardware wizards, Butler Lampson and Chuck Thacker. Together, they created the Alto. Chuck Thacker. For a while, we actually called the Alto the Interim Dynabook because it allowed Alan to do a lot of the software things that he wanted to do on the Dynabook. and so he actually paid for the first 12 machines or something like that. Terry Winograd. With a lot of this stuff at Park, Alan had the vision, and the tech guys like Butler Lampson and Chuck Thacker actually did it. Alan Kay. Chuck basically designed the whole Alto from start to finish in just a little over 3 months. That's why Chuck got that touring award. It was magic. Dan Ingalls. So the Alto was a beautifully designed mini computer that had a removable disk pack and a bitmap display, and lots of computing power for creating images on a black and white display. Chuck Thacker. And so the bitmap display was one of the key good ideas in the Alto. The idea was that you could represent the picture on the screen as a pile of bits in memory, and that any program could manipulate those bits and produce a picture. Alan Kay. The bitmap display acted as silicon paper that could show any image, and this led directly to bitmap painting, animation, and typography. Butler Lampson. We thought a really important aspect of interactive computing was to be able to simulate as many of the properties of paper as possible. It's a technology that's been around for a long, long time. Bob Taylor. We saw that if we had a personal computer with a bitmap display, that we could then use it for a lot of different things that people had not been using computers for. And that's what we did. Butler Lampson. But initially the Alto wasn't that much of a hit, because we had no interest in software development. It was only after we started to have things like Bravo that it really got hot. Charles Simonyi. The Alto had a black and white bitmap display. It had a mouse, and so it was clear that quite a beautiful editor could be written for the Alto. The Alto needed an editor, and I needed a PhD thesis, so that's why the name Bravo. It was the second experiment for my PhD thesis. Butler Lampson. Bravo was a joint project between Charles Simonyi and myself. Charles Simonyi. We finished it in about 3 months. The first version didn't have formatting yet, but it was attractive enough that Larry Tesler kind of picked up on it. Bruce Horn. Larry Tesler is one of the inventors of the modeless text editing concept, where you clicked and typed at the insertion point. Larry Tesler. Bravo was fairly low on modes at the beginning, but if you were in command mode and not typing mode and you typed the word edit, which would be a common thing we would type because we were building editing systems, E would select the entire document. E was shorthand for entire. And then when you typed the D in edit mode, it would delete the whole document. Then when you typed I, it would go into insert mode. So when you typed T, it would insert the T. Charles Simonyi. So all your work disappeared and T appeared on the screen. Bruce Horn. Larry would wear a t-shirt that said no modes on it. We got a big laugh out of that. Charles Simonyi. The first really useful version was in early 75. It really worked like a modern word processor. Chuck Thacker. Bravo morphed into Microsoft Word. Laurel was an almost recognizable email system, recognizable today. PostScript came from us. We had a lot of drawing applications, so it was a good run. Alan Kay. If you had come to Park 4 or 5 years after it started, you would have been in the midst of something. There were probably 150 Altos by then. Ethernets all over the place, laser printers were starting to appear. Charles Simonyi. About that time we had a lot of visitors, the first time probably in history that non-professionals, especially spouses of researchers and friends of researchers, came in at night to use computers. That never happened before. The most persistent visitor was Alvy Ray Smith. He had dropped out of academia after realizing that what he really wanted was to be an artist, and he was searching for a new direction in life. One of the Park researchers, Dick Shoup, was an old friend and invited Smith to the lab. Reluctantly, Smith came. And when Smith saw what Shoup was up to, he stayed. Alvy Ray Smith. I was a weekend hippie, I got my PhD at Stanford while I was hanging out in the parks. Dick Shoup has long hair, but he was never a hippie. He never dropped acid or anything like that. He's out on his own strange limb of the universe. Dick Shoup. I've always been into parapsychology and psychic phenomena and strange phenomena. And UFOs are even more of a third rail than psychic phenomena. And as usual, there's a tremendous amount of noise and hallucination, and just plain misidentification of something in the sky, stuff like that. But there's also plenty of very, very good evidence. I think there's really something going on. Alvy Ray Smith. And we kind of hit it off at a conference, and then he takes off to Xerox Park. And so he stayed in touch. Even at Park, Dick was always kind of out on his own branch. Dick Shoup. There were lots of ideas about what the group should do, and then people had individual things they wanted to do. And I had some ideas about what I wanted to do. Graphics. I always wanted to do graphics. Alvy Ray Smith. He decided that he wanted to build this artist machine, and he built the whole thing. The computational guts of it was a Nova mini computer, not an Alto. Altos were being made all around, but Dick needed more horsepower. Bob Taylor. Dick had opted to use a Nova instead of an Alto. Well, that put him at odds with everybody else in the lab. Alvy Ray Smith. They were always trying to get him to come into the mainstream. And then he built this picture memory, as he called it, a frame buffer. It was a magical device that had enough memory to hold a video picture, so roughly 500 by 500 pixels, and then display it using the standard NTSC-compatible video. All this is new. Dick Shoup. Not too many people were doing color, and in particular within Park and within Xerox, it was anathema. Because the Alto was just black and white pixels, and a lot of what other people were doing was just black and white. But I thought that if we were going to do video, to do anything remotely related to television as opposed to office documents, it was important to have color. Butler Lampson, which is much more expensive because you need at least 8 bits for each point instead of one. Dick Shoup. I was diverging a lot from what most of Park was doing because they were orienting themselves around office systems and documents and the laser printing and document creation and editing, text editing, book editing, publication stuff and so forth, for which black and white was much more appropriate. I thought the color was interesting, personally, and I thought that Xerox ought to damn well be interested in that, not just black and white memos. Bob Taylor. Then Dick brought in the so-called artists who were not computerists and therefore had little in common with the rest of us. Alvy Ray Smith. I didn't really understand what I was walking into. I walked into the great heyday of Park, and Dick took me into his lab and blew my mind. Dick Shoup. I was making a train wreck of these two giant technologies, computers and television. Alvy Ray Smith. I went, oh, that's what he's been talking about. Bruce Horn. I remember the room was always kind of dark, and so there was a big monitor, and it was like, look at this thing. Alvy Ray Smith. Now everybody just grows up knowing what a paint program is, and that if you move the mouse, this thing happens up there. But nobody understood it at the time. Bruce Horn. It was psychedelic. It was mind-blowing. Alvy Ray Smith. SuperPaint was a whole video graphics system, hardware and software. Dick Shoup could do both. He built all the hardware and wrote all the software. Dick's machine was the first to have 8 bits of color. 256 different colors. Enough to be interesting. And I went nuts. Bruce Horn. It was very, very unlike all the stuff we were doing, which was on the Alto and in black and white. Alvy Ray Smith. Nobody had ever seen full color and graphics ever before, and he had it. You could paint in full color. And I saw it, and I thought, that's my future. That's it. It might have been the second visit where I stayed for like 15 hours or something. Anyhow, basically, that's how we bonded on a permanent level. Jim Clark. Alvey and Shoup were always the artists. I do not know how you define artist, but I know one when I see one. I never was one. Bob Flegel. Alvey didn't get hired. I don't think he was even paid. He just came in on his own. We got him permission to come in. Alvey Ray Smith. One of the first things I did on Dick's machine was the walk cycle, a silly pirate walking across the screen. I started teaching myself from this Preston Blair book by animating on this machine. Blair was this great animator who did the dancing hippos for Fantasia. The book had the classic walk cycle and the run cycle. And it had a striptease. All the stuff. Adele Goldberg. You learn by playing. And Alvey just always had that twinkle of someone who played. It was a passion. And that passion was shared by a network of colleagues who he would bring in. Creative people. And Alvey is certainly one of those people. Bob Flegel. Alvey was such a character. Dick Shoup. People were doing things in the middle of the night, painting and maybe smoking something. Alvey Ray Smith. I would come home at like 4 in the morning, typically, because I'd stay until I dropped. I'd come home and crash and be up as soon as I could and go back in and keep going and keep going and keep going. It was so much fun. It was just a thrill a minute. Every day I was just flipping out. It was hard to go to sleep because it was so much fun, tearing the world apart. Every day, everything you touched had never been seen before, or never been thought of before, or codified before. Just everything that happened was new. We used to sit around and talk about how this was what it felt like to be with Balboa in Panama or something. You know, the first guys ashore, the first Europeans ashore, and you get to name everything? It was the early days, right? Dick Shoup. Some very strange images came out from Alvey and others. Alvey Ray Smith. I had a friend, David DeFrancesco, that would come down at night. He was a video artist. That's what he did in the city. And we would jam. I would make pictures for a while and then just turn over to him, and he would take what I left and he would work away on it, and then he turned it back to me. I mean, none of it was worth saving, but it was lots of fun. Just crazy stuff. And meanwhile, we're talking about all the fun stuff that's going on and the hippie thing and drugs and so forth. We really hit it off. Dick Shoup. Was it a fancy pants salon art rave? It was getting there. Alvey Ray Smith. People would be dropping by all the time to see. They'd heard about this machine and they'd drive by. Boy, everybody came to look at it. Dick Shoup. I'm sure if we had let it get bigger, it would have turned into a real party. It was pushing the boundaries, and it could have gone much farther. And some people think we had gone too far already. But I didn't think so. It was pretty modest, really, compared to what was going on in the world as a whole at that time. So it wasn't all that outrageous. Adele Goldberg. Bob Flegel, who's a marvelous artist, and Dick Shoup told me a fabulous story that I bought into because I'm a little naive. They said that they were making a monster movie. I think what they really told me was that they were making some monster sex movie, and I left that to them. Bob Flegel. I was doing a fair amount of drinking at the time, so who knows? We had a lot of fun there, all of us. Alvey Ray Smith. I just sat around and made art all day. That's what I did. I just made art. It was only after I was there for a while I realized, hey, I'm a programmer. I can make it do what I want it to do. So I started creating programs, and I would record the output onto video. And then eventually I edited all of it together into a piece I called VidBits. And that was my entry into the New York avant-garde art scene. Bob Taylor. Alvey loved to interview. He loved to be a spokesman for something, and he would talk about Park as though he were an insider, and gave people the impression that he was an expert on Park. So a lot of people would go to him and say, tell us about Park. And he would, but he didn't know much about Park. He was a self-promoter. Alvey Ray Smith. They were trimming back anything that was hippie-like or avant-garde, and that meant me. I didn't want my art associated with them. Dick Shoup. Taylor got fed up with Alvy and the wacky graphics we were doing in the late nights and whatever else was going on, and he said we shouldn't do that anymore, and he wanted to just cancel the project as a whole. Alvy Ray Smith. One day Bob Taylor came into the lab, Dick's lab, where I worked every day, and he was puffing on his famous pipe. Bruce Horn. Bob was into smoking his pipe. Alvy Ray Smith. And he said, Alvy, do you agree with me that over here in the corner is more the direct line of computer graphics than what Dick Shoup is doing? Off in the corner was an Alto, with a black and white display, just doing really crude one-bit graphics. I've got 8 bits and full color. Who cares about one-bit graphics? All of a sudden, inside, my heart just sunk, and I went, oh my God, this guy hasn't got a clue. He's basically not supporting Dick Shoup, who's got the greatest idea of all. So although I've heard great things about Bob Taylor, my impression of the guy was he just didn't get it. Stuart Brand. Bob was a close student, actually, of computer games. He took the same attitude I did, that this was where he could see a lot of the most important trends in interactivity that people would have with computers. But he got slapped and constrained by Xerox Corporate back east. Alvy Ray Smith. I got the call from Jerry Elkind, my boss. He says, we're going to let you go. And I went, well, why? And he said, well, we've decided not to do color. I said, but Mr. Elkind, the future is color. It's obvious. And Xerox owns it completely. He said, well, that may be so, but it's a corporate decision to go black and white. Okay, bye. Dick Shoup. Alvy got the boot. Bob Taylor. Alvy was an asshole. Alvy Ray Smith. Several years later, Dick Shoup and Xerox PARC got a technical Emmy for Super Paint, and what was used to seal the deal was VidBits, my calling card. And of course, Xerox PARC tried to deny any association with this thing. Stuart Brand. Xerox PARC went from freewheeling and free thinking and openly connected to shut off and under suspicious corporate oversight. It was the beginning of the end. Breakout. Jobs and Woz changed the game. When Xerox PARC and Atari were both just getting started, so were two Silicon Valley whiz kids, Steve Wozniak and his best buddy and sometime business partner Steve Jobs. In the spring and summer of 1972, they built and sold blue boxes door-to-door in the UC Berkeley dorms. The highly illegal electronic gizmos emitted tones that could be played into a telephone to trick Ma Bell's switching equipment into letting the bearer of the blue box place free long-distance calls. Selling blue boxes was a lucrative sideline, but ultimately too risky. By January 1973, both Steves had dropped out of college and went looking for real jobs. Woz landed at the staid and respectable Hewlett-Packard, while Jobs wound up at the hippest new startup in Silicon Valley, Atari. After a few years of feverish after-hours hacking by Woz, and for Jobs a mind-expending trip to India, the two friends founded their own computer company. Steve Jobs. I don't think there would have ever been an Apple computer had there not been blue boxing. Dan Kotke. The blue box article came out in 1971. Captain Crunch. Ron Rosenbaum wrote The Secrets of the Little Blue Box in Esquire magazine. Ron Rosenbaum. It was only my second magazine story. Steve Jobs. It was about this guy named Captain Crunch who could supposedly make free telephone calls. Captain Crunch. You can do what a telephone operator can do even more, including calling overseas and deciding whether you want to go through cable or through a satellite. Ron Rosenbaum. Woz's mother sent Woz the Esquire piece, and Woz couldn't believe it could be real. Captain Crunch. You can route the calls through different cities, hiding your location. They can trace the calls all they want. They'll never find you. That's how, for instance, I was able to call the CIA crisis hotline into the White House. I told Nixon that we needed toilet paper, that there was a toilet paper crisis. Steve Jobs. We were captivated. How could anybody do this? And we thought it must be a hoax. And we started looking through the libraries, looking for the secret tones that would allow you to do this. And we were at Stanford Linear Accelerator Center one night, and way in the bowels of their technical library, way down at the last bookshelf in the corner bottom rack, we found an AT&T technical journal that laid out the whole thing. And that's another moment I'll never forget. When we saw this journal, we thought, my God, it's all real. Steve Wozniak. So I designed this little box, and Steve said, oh, let's sell it. Are you serious? And then Jobs and Woz manufactured those blue boxes. Captain Crunch. And I met Steve Wozniak, Steve Jobs, and one or two more individuals who were UC Berkeley students. Steve Wozniak was going there for his engineering degree. Steve Wozniak. We both sold it to people in the dorms for a year. Ron Rosenbaum. It was the beginning of the Apple partnership, even though, as far as I can tell, they weren't very good at it then. Steve Jobs. We built the best blue box in the world. It was all digital. Captain Crunch. Their blue boxes were not pure. You use those blue boxes, you go to jail. I drilled it into Woz. After I met him in the dorm, I said, Steve, you really don't want to be selling these. I'm going to give you some advice. I'm talking to you from an analog engineer's point of view, not from a digital engineer's like you are. I deal in analog signals, not digital. Analog signals are much more complicated, and they are not as cut and dry as digital signals. I told him, I said, when you put those tones together by whatever means of injection into the phone line, you are going to drop a trouble card. They will notice it immediately. I made that very clear to Steve. He didn't seem to care. Steve Wozniak. I liked exploring the network and being able to convince a Tokyo operator that I was a New York operator and get her to put it over to London and around the world. And I'd call one phone and speak into my phone, and it would come out the other one a second later. Steve Jobs. And you might ask, well, what's so interesting about that? What's so interesting is that we were young, and what we learned was that we could build something ourselves that could control billions of dollars worth of infrastructure in the world. And that was an incredible lesson. But after being robbed of a blue box at gunpoint in the parking lot of a Sunnyvale pizza parlor while trying to close a sale, Woz and Jobs decided to shut down their illegal business. The venture wasn't making much money, and besides, Silicon Valley had just spawned something even more exciting than phone freaking. Atari had just invented the video game industry. Steve Wozniak. I had a friend that worked at Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab, so I'd ride my bike over there, and it was just open. You know, smart people are always open thinkers, and they don't lock doors. So I walked right in. Space War was running on a PDP-11 there, and wow! You had the spaceship going around, being pulled by gravity into the center. So that was the idea of what could come in arcade games. But it was so expensive, no person could ever afford it. Nolan Bushnell. The big XY displays were about $20,000 at the time. Steve Wozniak. But then I saw a real arcade game, and that was Pong, and I was stunned. My God, the television set solves the problem of the cost. The movement toward the games we have today was largely one of how do you do it at a reasonable cost that people can afford? That was a big challenge, you know. I thought, oh my gosh, I know how TVs work. I know all their signals for drawing lines and drawing frames and putting dots on the screen. So I built a little device, 28 little $1 chips, and I built my own Pong. But it was hardware. See, nowadays, you would just write a game of Pong in software, and if you kind of know what you're doing, it might even take you a day or 2 days. Back then, it was hardware. That was a different world.
Steve Jobs. I decided I wanted to travel, but I was lacking the necessary funds. I was looking in the paper, and there was this ad that said, have fun and make money. I called. It was Atari. Al Alcorn. I enjoyed getting these people that were really bright that wanted to come to work and do fun things. The semiconductor business wasn't much fun. It was like that Ampex model. Atari was probably the most fun place to work at the time in the Valley. David Kushner. Atari was the company that established Silicon Valley's casual culture as we know it today. Just the idea of showing up to work in jeans and a t-shirt? Prior to Atari, the Valley was the era of Intel, and essentially men in suits. With Atari, it became smelly hippies in jeans smoking weed. Atari was the counterculture come to Silicon Valley. And so it was no coincidence that one of the smelly hippies that walked into Atari was Steve Jobs. Steve Wozniak. I did a copy of Pong in 28 chips, and two of the chips put a four-letter word on the screen when you missed the ball. I'm into humor. And I showed it to my friends at Hewlett-Packard, and then Steve came into town, and he saw it, and he took my board to Atari. Al Alcorn. One day the personnel lady came in and said, I know you like to see these walk-ins. I've got one for you, an 18-year-old hippie. I said, bring him in. Steve Wozniak. I don't know if he was telling them that he had designed it, or he and another guy had designed it, or what, but I'm sure they were impressed by it. Al Alcorn. Jobs had a resume which was pretty much nothing. He dropped out of Reed College. I go, well, was Reed an electrical engineering school? No, it's a literary school.
He's not an engineer, but he had spark and enthusiasm. And he could solder.
I needed a tech, so I hired him. Nolan Bushnell. Jobs was a technician, basically someone who did a lot of the actual soldering. Steve Jobs. I was like employee number 40. It was a small company. They had made Pong and two other games. Nolan Bushnell. He came to me one time and said, no one in this company knows how to solder. I looked at some of his work, and it's just pristine. He was extraordinary. I said, well, teach everybody. So he did. He was not kind in doing it, but I actually think he upped our game somewhat. Lee Felsenstein. In 1974, I found myself standing in front of Al Alcorn's desk at Atari looking for a job. And it was Jobs who conducted me into that office. Jobs was wearing a nice little white shirt. He might have had a tie. He had a scuzzy beard. It wasn't the mythical Jobs, let's put it that way. He didn't exist yet. I think this was before his India trip. Al Alcorn. He had this weird diet. He would pass out occasionally, and he said, don't call 911 if I pass out. Just push me under the table. Oh, okay. Dan Kotke. Steve had found the mucusless diet healing system, which is a fruitarian diet for healing. It's not like it cured anything. In fact, it's not a great diet. It's just sugar. Nolan Bushnell. Steve was brash. He was difficult. He didn't bathe. And subsequent to Al hiring him, Steve and I got to be friends. Steve was very, very up to speed on Eastern philosophy. I was very up to speed on Western philosophy. And we would have these interesting conversations, which I really liked. Dan Kotke. I don't think that Steve had a spiritual phase, not really. The whole thing for Steve was that he was always looking for a mentor. He was actively looking for a mentor. Nolan Bushnell. Steve had one speed, full on, and I was always impressed by that. Al Alcorn. Jobs was impressive, but not that impressive. Dan Kotke. Kobunshino Otagawa was the roshi, or teacher, at the Los Altos Zendo. I'm not sure when Steve first met him, but the very first time I came down from Reed to visit, Steve brought me to the Zendo, and we did the meditation. Steve was big on doing that a few times a week. Kobun was his mentor. Kobunshino Otagawa. Steve always say, make me monk.
Please make me Monk. I say no. Nolan Bushnell. I think Steve perceived himself to be a deep thinker on philosophical issues. Dan Kottke. Eastern literature, Hare Krishna food, and then psychedelics. That was part of the mix. Steve Jobs. This was California. You could get LSD fresh made from Stanford. You could sleep on the beach at night with your girlfriend. California has a sense of experimentation and openness. Openness to new possibilities. Dan Kottke. And I just assumed that Steve had taken LSD in high school. But all these years later, I pretty much know who all his friends were then, and I can't think of any of them who would have taken LSD. Certainly not Woz. Steve Wozniak. I never used LSD. Or even pot. Dan Kottke. So I might have turned him on. Steve Jobs. I'd been turned on to the idea of enlightenment and trying to figure out who I was and how I fit into things. Dan Kottke. Steve was looking for a guru who would tap him on the head and make him enlightened. Al Alcorn. I remember when he said, I'm going to go to India to meet my guru. I said, well, great. Dan Kottke. I dropped out of Reed to go to India. Steve generously offered to buy my ticket. $800. I was carrying a stack of books. Steve was looking for his enlightenment experience. There was one pilgrimage we took where we went to Kainji, which was where Neem Karoli's ashram was. Larry Brilliant. Neem Karoli Baba is the guru of Baba Ram Das, and Danny Coleman and a lot of other people you've heard of a little bit. Ram Das wrote a book called Be Here Now, which was about Neem Karoli Baba. He had 100 different names. Neem Karoli Baba, Blanket Baba, Maharaj Ji. He was a guru, probably in his 80s, and he had an ashram or a monastery. I say monastery sometimes just to make it seem more familiar, but it didn't train monks. It trained people who were interested in being enlightened. By the time they got there, Neem Karoli Baba had died. Dan Kottke. It was deserted. Completely deserted. It had been a huge scene only a year before. Larry Brilliant. Steve wanted to find a guru. There were other gurus in the hills, and he became interested in one called Haryakan Baba. Dan Kottke. And then we took this pilgrimage to see Haryakan Baba. Larry Brilliant. And Steve followed Haryakan Baba through the forests, barefoot, and Haryakan Baba told him to cut his hair, and so he shaved his head. Al Alcorn. And he came back a few months later. I remember Ron Wayne came in and said, hey, Stevie is back. And I said, Steve who? Steve Jobs. Oh, that kid, yeah. Oh, bring him in.
And I wish I had a camera.
He was wearing a saffron robe, shaved head, barefoot, had a Baba Ram Das book, Be Here Now. Steve gives me the Baba Ram Das book and says, can I have my job back? Sure. Nolan Bushnell. Steve was creating too much havoc in the engineering department, so I decided to put him on the night shift, knowing that I would get two Steves at the price of one. Steve Wozniak. I got to play Grand Track 10, the first car game, before it was out. Steve Jobs. I would just let him in at night and let him onto the production floor, and he would play Grand Track all night long. Al Alcorn. I had the responsibility to get these games out, coin-op games. The number one responsibility is to keep the factory going, right? But Nolan had a very short attention span, and he'd come into engineering and change the product halfway through. Well, they're never going to ship if you keep doing that. So I had a pager installed, and when Nolan went into engineering, they'd buzz me. That way Nolan could talk all he wanted, but later I'd come in and I would get everything set back on course. I had to do that. I had to get things to ship. Nolan Bushnell. I had designed this game that was called Breakout, and I couldn't get any of our engineers to do it. We had this thing where engineers could bid on projects, and the perception was that ball and paddle games were over. We'd done Pong, Pong doubles, quadra pong, what have you. About as much ball and paddle as you can do. And so everybody thought ball and paddle was over, and breakout was a ball and paddle. Al Alcorn. And so Nolan went around me, and he cornered Steve Jobs to go do breakout. Nolan didn't know that Steve wasn't an engineer. That's a fact. He thought Steve was an engineer, and Jobs never dissuaded him of that notion. Nolan Bushnell. I thought, okay, I'll put Steve on it, knowing that Wozniak was actually going to do this stuff, and they knocked it out in an amazingly short time. Steve Wozniak. Steve Jobs came to me, and he said that Atari wanted me to design Breakout, and I had only 4 days to do it. This was a half-a-man-year project. It was all in hardware. 4 days. I didn't think I could do it, but I'd already done Pong, so it was really just an extension of that game. It was just putting in the reflection, counting when you hit bricks. We went 4 days with no sleep. Steve and I both got mononucleosis, the sleeping sickness, but we delivered a working breakout game. Al Alcorn. By this time, Jobs was working for Harold Lee, and Jobs shows Harold this breakout game that wasn't even on the list of things to do. Steve alleges to Harold that, "I, Steve Jobs, designed it." And Harold looks at the design and was like, "What the hell? I mean, I've never seen a design like this." And he said, "If Jobs did this, I'm really blown away." Steve Wozniak. Supposedly the Atari engineers couldn't understand my design. It was just so beautiful and advanced. I never got to talk to them. I don't know if they knew that I did. Al Alcorn. Here was Breakout in like 40 integrated circuits. I couldn't do Pong in less than 70. Steve Wozniak. Atari was getting tired of their engineers designing games with 150 chips, 160 chips, 190 chips in them. Al Alcorn. And Nolan had said, if you make the game with anything less than 50 chips, you'll get a 1,000 per chip bonus, pretty well knowing there is no way you could do less than 50. Steve Wozniak. Steve had asked me how many chips my design was. I said, it looks like 45 chips. He said, if we get it under 50 chips, we get $700. But if we get it under 40 chips, we get 1,000. He was motivating me to get it down. Nolan Bushnell. They came in at, I think, 45 chips. The deal was that they got a bonus. Steve Wozniak. They paid Steve Jobs, and then he paid me half the money, supposedly. He told me that we would get paid $700. Nolan Bushnell. It was about $5,000. Steve Wozniak. Then he wrote me a check for $350. So whatever, Steve should have been more open and honest with me. He should have told me differently because we were such close friends. But the fun of doing it overrides anything like that. Who cares about money? Right after we finished the game, he went up to Oregon and bought into that orchard, or whatever it was. Dan Kotke. It was apple harvest time, and Steve may have stayed there longer than me, but I was there for like a week doing the apple harvest. We were fasting on apples. It was our fruitarian experiment. And that's why the name Apple was in the air. Also in the air, thanks to Stuart Brand's 1972 Rolling Stone article, was the idea of a personal computer. Brand coined the phrase after meeting Alan Kay at Xerox PARC. There were lots of personal computers at PARC. The Altos. But it wasn't until the release of the Altair, a build-it-yourself computer kit that an ordinary hobbyist could get his or her hands on one. It was all the excuse the hackers in Silicon Valley needed to get together. The first meeting of the Homebrew Computer Club was held in 1975, and no one was more excited about it than Woz. Steve Wozniak. I realized that finally the day had come when you could buy low-enough-cost memory chips, low-enough-cost microprocessors that did enough to build an affordable computer. And I thought, wow, this is what I've wanted for 10 years. I've got it. I'm there. Steve Jobs. The clubs were based around a computer kit called the Altair. Jim Warren. The Altair was what really started the hustle and go around microcomputing, but the Altair was a pretty shoddy design. Steve Jobs. You didn't even type. You threw switches that signaled characters. Steve Wozniak. A bunch of switches and lights, and you can push a button and some ones and zeros go to memory? That's geeky computer stuff. That's not usable. Jim Warren. And Woz, he looked at the Altair and thought, okay, but it doesn't do exactly what I want it to do. So hey, why don't I design one? Michael Malone. People started realizing that this stuff could be done by people who weren't business people. And they weren't PhDs in electrical engineering. It could just be done by smart kids. Lee Felsenstein. Woz was there from the beginning with his high school cadre, Randy Wigginton and Chris Espinoza, prominent among them. Randy Wigginton. We knew that everything was changing. Mainframes were not the future. And even mini computers were just continuing to shrink very quickly. And that's why everybody was so excited. Steve Wozniak. I'd already built a terminal that talked to faraway computers, and I just did it for fun. It was a hobby. Lee Felsenstein. The terminal was mentioned in the first meeting. Woz was there at the first meeting and just kept coming. Randy Wigginton. Then MOS Technology started selling the 6502 for $25 each. Dan Kotke. The 6502 was way, way cheaper than the 8080 in the Altair. Chuck Thacker. At Park, we used a 6502 in our keyboards for digitizing the stream that went down to the computer. The 6502 was the keyboard controller. Steve Jobs. It was the computer hobbyist community that first thought about making a computer out of these things. Randy Wigginton. Woz bought some and then went home and figured out how to hook it into the terminal. Steve Jobs. And so what an Apple I was really an extension of this terminal, putting a microprocessor on the back end. Randy Wigginton. That's how the whole Apple I came to be. And it was really fast. Steve Wozniak. I was a hero at the club. I had built a computer. I had given the plans away for free. I helped others build it. Lee Felsenstein. And then, of course, what's missing was any software to make it go. And that's why Woz was writing BASIC in less than 256 bytes. Steve Wozniak. I called my BASIC Game BASIC, and my whole idea was if you write a language that can play games, it can do all the things that computers do that I don't know about. Financial stuff? I don't know what companies use computers for. I only know what I like to use them for, and it's games. Lee Felsenstein. Then this guy turns up at Homebrew in the spring of 1976, who doesn't say anything. I thought of him as that rat-faced kid who hung around Wozniak and never said anything. He was the business guy. Steve Wozniak. Steve came into town, and I said, you've got to come down and see this. Randy Wigginton. Steve was never very technical, even though he liked to say he was, but he really never was. I don't know that he could actually program or design hardware. I never saw any evidence of it. He was more interested in the Homebrew Computer Club as a way to make a business. I mean, he just wanted to work for himself. He always wanted to be in control of his own destiny. He really wanted to be rich when he was young. Steve Wozniak. Steve wasn't into social good. He was into, do we have something that can make money? He was always looking at that. He'd been selling my stuff for 5 years. He'd come into town about once every couple years and see what I'd created lately, and he'd turn it into money. He was really money-oriented at the start. Dan Kotke. So Steve Jobs had nothing to do with the Apple I. Woz just completely did it on his own. Showed it off to Jobs, and Jobs was thinking, ka-ching, cash registers. Steve Wozniak. He suggested that we make a company. Steve Jobs. I sold my Volkswagen bus, and Steve sold his calculator, and we got enough money to pay a friend of ours to make the artwork. to make a printed circuit board. And we made some printed circuit boards, and we sold some to our friends. And I was trying to sell the rest of them so that we could get our microbus and calculator back. Steve Wozniak.